something about something that's happened. I don't know if it's happening or an idea that women before they're married grow their hair longer, and then they cut their hair used as a shaver for after they're married. And is polygamy an issue with that? Or?
I'm sorry. What is the advantage that of doing that?
Because then it's what's the advantage of doing it?
Yeah. Why would they grow their hair longer?
They grow their hair longer and then cut their hair, and then that hair would be used for a shaver.
Oh, I'm sorry. Their own hair, you mean?
Right. Their own hair.
Yeah. Well, Mi'ikar HaDin, it is permitted. It is permitted to use your own. Well, let me start off generally. As you know, there is a very big machlokas about shekels generally. There are many poskim, Sfardim, and many Ashkenazic poskim in Eretz Yisrael who actually believe that none of the wigs are permitted, because they claim that if the problem of a married woman's uncovered hair is the sexual attractiveness of it, a shekel might look nicer than her natural hair. And therefore they require a tichel, that hair be covered with a kerchief or a hat or whatever. So obviously according to those poskim, this would not be an etza, but you're asking, according to the poskim, most American poskim, that you allow a wig. So the question would be, could there even be a wig out of your own hair? So strangely enough, Mi'ikar HaDin, it is mutter. Now you might say, well, what sense does that make? I mean, after all, her own hair, it's her own hair, and if her own hair is forbidden if it's growing out of her head, why would her own hair be permitted if it's cut off? So part of it is a mystical idea, that it says that the Yetzer Hara, that is stimulated by Re'ia, is somehow affected only by what is connected to the woman's body and not what is disattached. How does the Yetzer Hara know that? Well, it has to obviously be something on a spiritual level. I mean, the observer wouldn't necessarily know. Others make a point that the chiyuv of a married woman covering her hair is not so much for the observer. It's rather an internal recognition for the woman herself that her inner essence is to be reserved for her husband and herself and for Hashem and not for public consumption. And therefore, as long as she knows her hair is covered, it really makes no difference. So, logically, from a matter of common sense, it would not seem to work, but Lamaisa, poskim permit shekels, even permit that shekel. The only issue you might raise is marisayan, meaning to say, if a woman wears a shekel that's not her hair, that's one thing. If you wear a shekel that is her hair, people could easily think it is her, she's not covering hair, so marisayan is a concern. In fact, that was one of the signs, you know, when a woman is a sota, when she's suspected of adultery, we uncover her hair, so one of the signs here, a lot of signs against wigs, I don't know if you follow them, the Pashkavilin, they're called. The Pashkavil says, you know, why would a woman want to look like a sota? Why does she want to pretend that she's a sota? You know, what type of kavod is that? So that might be an issue. But it is permitted. Yeah.
I'm wondering if Baruch Matanis, it seems that in the non-Jewish world, there seems to be quite a propensity for people to have demonic possession. I was wondering if that's if there's something to that, or if we shouldn't give credence to that at all.
You mean exorcisms? What do you mean?
Exorcisms, that sort of thing.
Well, in the Jewish world too, it happens. Listen, we do believe in such a metzias. Now, most of the time, even the Chafetz Chaim said that people that act possessed are simply psychologically sick. They need to go to a hospital. They need medical treatment. We don't look at it as a spiritual manifestation of being possessed by a demon. So most so-called demonic possessions are really schizophrenia, breakdowns, mental illness. And they should be addressed that way. In fact, people go to, you know, Rav Hillel is our mekubel here, our local mekubel across the streets. And I call him, maybe it's disrespectful, but I call him the non-mekubel mekubel, because people come to him and they always, you know, want to get some Kabbalistic problem. You know, I can't find the shidduch, you know, is there something in my palm that's not correct? And he'll always say, you know, learn more, daven more, go to a doctor more. You know, he very, very rarely describes something in a mystical way, because he says mystical is like when you have no other explanation, you explain it that way, but there are often many, many other explanations. So a lot of people will come to him with mental breakdowns. They want to know, am I possessed by a D-book, by a soul that cannot find a body? And he says, no, you just need to go to a psychiatric hospital or whatever. But having said all that, lemaisa, there is a core of situations where a shay, the mazik, can't possess a person. And it's very subtle. Sometimes it's a demon, and sometimes it's a neshama that's condemned to wander the earth, and it's looking for a body to inhabit because that's more comfortable. Sometimes it drives out your existing soul. Sometimes it's coexisting with your existing soul. So there's going to be a lot of conflict. And there are ceremonies and there are rituals that involve driving this out. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, used on Purim only, he would speak about a long, long maisa, how he helped the Chafetz Chaim take a dibuk away from a woman that was possessed, and the Chafetz Chaim, you know, used the koach of Torah and the like. So such things do exist, but I think the accounts are often over-exaggerated, and sometimes people will fanatically interpret it to be that type of dark spiritual phenomenon, when in fact it might just be mental illness. But I'm not aware. I haven't been aware of a lot of reports of this. I don't know. And certainly, I would imagine that the Christian ceremonies for driving demons out would not be that effective, because they just don't have any koach. So maybe it's a placebo effect, meaning somebody thinks they're possessed by a demon, and I do something that seems like it's driving it out, then psychologically they drive it out. But if it's a real metzias, I don't think this could be effective in any way. But I'll check the numbers. I'm not aware of any rise in exorcisms in recent years. Yeah.
To connect to the question, what's the manifestation when you had at that time? What would be the manifestation?
Well, the manifestation would be a few things. The manifestation would be that voices would come out of you that are not your voices. There would be deep voices, loud voices, but very scary voices as well. And the voice would talk about experiences that you never had, experiences of somebody else's life, etc. The voices are often going to be very, very abusive. They will curse and blaspheme Chas v'Shalom, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, or the Torah, or various other tzaddikim, and the like. So it's literally like there's somebody else inside of you, meaning it's not you, it's a different voice, it's a different personality. But as I say, some of this is characteristic of schizophrenia as well, split personalities, right? So it's only a gadol or sometimes a trained professional might be able to be mavchin between schizophrenia and demonic possession. Huh?
Just
down the
left,
like, oh, how does it
go? Like,
yeah, you wake
just
up.
Say,
yeah, person. I mean, basically, a person has a breakdown, and all of a sudden, you know, it starts off that you faint or something like that, and you're in a trance, and you start talking as if there's another person inside of you. Yeah, yeah.
According to the Rambam, who says that these things
are just... Well, that's a good question. According to the Rambam, yeah, according to the Rambam, if there's no such thing, then you're right. L'chara would have to be... there couldn't be such a thing as demonic possession, because there's no such thing as demons. So the Rambam obviously would have to attribute it to psychological or physical breakdowns. It would have to be that way, because there is no other explanation. However, it's complicated, and I can't say I'm an expert in this, because it comes in many, many varieties. And that is, even if the Rambam would deny demonic possession, but there's another type in which there's a neshama that cannot find rest that possesses you. That's different. That's not a demon. That's a neshama. Now, the Rambam also admits there's such a thing as neshama, obviously. And therefore, perhaps the Rambam would admit that you can be possessed by a ghost, so to speak, even if you couldn't be possessed by a demon. So you'd have to be mechalik. And what are the simonim that differentiate one from the other is also something that we're not so lucky about. Okay, yeah.
Feminism seems to be a massive issue, and I also wrote a few weeks ago about this, that you should marry a woman.
Yeah,
to what extent can we and should we allow for greater female participation in Jewish religious life? How far can we go?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a very, very amazing comment by the Vilna Gaon, The Vilna Gaon says a fascinating thought. He says the so-called inferior status, and that's really a so-called because men and women are not inferior, or women are not inferior to men at all. In fact, some Amori Chazal put them superior, but even if you go with everybody's equal, equality doesn't mean people do the same thing. Equality means women have unique responsibilities, such as having children, which a man cannot do, and men have their responsibilities. And to say that a woman can be significant only if she imitates a man is actually insulting a woman as opposed to celebrating her own role. But the so-called apparent inferiority in the public forum, where women cannot be rabbis, women are not chazanim, women are not edim, right, etc., the Vilna Gaon says it is connected to the curse of the sun and the moon. That originally the sun and the moon were equal, and not only that, but that means the moon gave light, gave its own light. And the moon said to Hashem, oh, how could it be? How can you have two kings who share one crown, thinking that the moon would become the boss? And Hashem diminished the power of the moon and made the sun dominant. Right? This is what the Chumash says. And the Vilna Gaon says, that is the secret of the apparent denigration of women in the world, because women are compared to the moon and men are compared to the sun. It is brought down in Chazal that when the Mashiach comes, or Tchiyas HaMesim, whatever specific level it's referring to, the light of the moon shall be equal to the light of the sun. And the Vilna Gaon says, it's a tremendous chiddush, he says, as we approach the Messianic era, the moon will get ever more powerful and be equal to the sun, and to some degree might even surpass the sun, as the Pasuk says, the woman shall surround the man. That's the source of a woman walking around, a kala walking around the chasen. So the Vilna Gaon is telling us an amazing thing. The Vilna Gaon wrote this way before there was feminism. And the Vilna Gaon says it'll be part of the messianic process that there will be a movement for the greater equality of women, the greater recognition of women, the greater understanding of the power that they have to contribute to Am Yisrael. And this will actually be part of the coming of the Mashiach, as there will be greater equality of men and women. Now the question becomes, so the girls are feminists, but they've only gone be in favor of women rabbis. Well, I can assure you that although I was not zochet to know the Vilna Gaon personally, not quite that old, but I assure you he would not have been in favor of women rabbis. And what you have here is something that Rav Kook used to describe, a very, very controversial idea, but I think it's tamun in the Graz Vilna Gaon's comments. That is, that sometimes great and powerful spiritual ideas come into the world, and those spiritual ideas are emes, and they're holy, and they bring us to a higher truth, but they get co-opted, they get kidnapped, they get hijacked, and those impulses are then directed into improper channels. But Rav Kook said, if you look at their shoresh, in many, many ways, they represent an authentic spiritual striving. Feminism, in many ways, therefore, at its core, represents a truly spiritual and beautiful idea. The dignity of men and women, the fact that they're equally beloved, and indeed it's part of the messianic process that women will have more apparent chashivas in the world. But it gets co-opted with people with an agenda, people who want power, people who are trying to imitate secular norms. So in a sense, just as Zionism, the return to Eretz Yisrael, is a wonderful, wonderful, holy idea, but it gets perverted when it's taken by people who want to rebel and reject the Torah, feminism too, at its inception, is a very, very important and significant idea, but it gets perverted. So basically, the problem we face is what secular ethicists call, the slippery slope. And slippery slope means that even if it's like a gezeira, you do things that are okay, but where is it going to lead? Meaning to say, in some sense, the notion of expanded learning for women was something that the Chafetz Chaim saw in the establishment of Beis Yaakov. Even the learning of Gemara, which the Rambam says not, but the truth of the matter is, the Prisha, one of the great Mefarshim on the Torah, says the issur of women learning Torah is only it's not expressed as it's usher for a woman to learn Torah. It says it's forbidden for the father to teach his daughter the Torah Shebaal Peh, meaning it shouldn't be forced on her, it shouldn't be mandatory, it shouldn't be, because most women, this is not the limud that is good for their neshamas. But if an individual adult woman wants to learn Gemara, the Prisha says Beferish, it is mutter for her to learn, and it is mutter for you to teach her. Again, subject to tznius and all. So it's one thing to say, let's have a 7th grade required class for Gemara for girls, like they have in Maimonides, which is halachically problematical. It's a totally different thing if adult women want to get together and have a Gemara class, as some modern schools have. So what I'm basically saying is that women should have expanded opportunities, women should have more learning opportunities. If women are going to college and taking philosophy or medicine or law or accounting, then clearly they should be able to learn Torah as well. But as I say, there's always a problem. Are you doing mitzvahs to serve Hashem? Are you doing mitzvahs for empowerment, for self-actualization, for ego, and the like? And therefore, feminism is an idea that has some fundamental goodness to it, but it is perverted. And when it becomes, and in its extreme manifestations, anti-family, anti-parenting, which sometimes it turns into, where a woman says, I don't want to get married because I want to spend a few years in Kollel first. It's the opposite of a man's question. A man says, I want to get married to go to Kollel. Some women are saying, I don't want to get married because I want to spend some time in Kollel. Then what's happening is you're perverting the whole tachlis. So the slippery slope basically says, well, if I go along with some of the agenda, are we gonna get pulled in the other, right? So that's a chashash that every rabbi has to grapple with. And I'll give you one practical example. You know, in some modern Orthodox congregations, well, it's really getting worse and worse. It used to be 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, the big issue was women's minyanim. Women wanted to have a minyan where they would do Kriyas HaTorah and those things, okay? According to Halacha, that's not proper. Kriyas HaTorah requires a minyan, and 9 men cannot read the Torah with a bracha. And if 9 men cannot read the Torah with a bracha, then 11 women are not better than 9 men. If you need a minyan of men, so you need a minyan, right? So the women's minyanim were no good, right? They were doing it, but al pi din, it was not a proper thing to do. And some women tried to finesse it by faking, and they would say the following: well, a woman can't make a bracha over the Torah, but a woman has to make Birchas HaTorah in the morning, so let's just tell a woman not to make her Birchas HaTorah in the morning, and when she gets called up for an aliyah, she'll make a bracha. I mean, this is like playing house. I mean, you know, you're playing house. Let's do it so she can make her aliyah by just not doing that other bracha and then creating a fake Kriyas HaTorah. I mean, are you using Kriyas HaTorah as a game to pretend, to play house, to play doctor? So let's say that's no good. Okay, but let's take another situation. Let's say I had in my show, we have bas mitzvahs. Girls make bas mitzvahs, which again, nothing per se wrong with celebrating a girl coming to mitzvahs. In fact, one might say it should be as important as a bar mitzvah. Okay, so usually it wasn't the girl, but her parents. Her parents were into this more than the girl herself. So they wanted to have a Friday night Kabbalah Shabbos service where women only, no men, women only, and they would say the 6 chapters of Tehillim, of Lechuna Ranana, and they would say Lecha Dodi. Okay, no Kaddish, no Kedusha, nothing that you need a minyan for. Now, clearly, there is nothing wrong with that, because essentially, all a Kabbalah Shabbos service is women sitting around, or standing around, and saying or singing Tehillim, together with Lecha Dodi, that doesn't require a minyan. So I used to permit that. I said, that's okay, that's perfectly fine. And it is mutter. The only thing is, some people went over to me, some more right-wing or more Haredi members of the shul, and they would say, you know, we want our daughters to marry people from Lakewood or Brisk or Mir, and they're going to hear that we come from a shul that has a Kabbalah Shabbos, you know, service for girls. They're going to think we're part of the feminist movement, and we're not going to get shidduchim for our children. Right? This is how it works. You know, people throw out the good even with the bad. But there is nothing wrong. But again, to some degree, it depends on motive. If you want to serve Hashem, that's fine. If it's just, we're as good as the boys, you know, whatever you do, I can do. That's a problem. Tefillin. Can women put on tefillin? Logically, they should be able to put on tefillin, because women are putter from tefillin only because it's a mitzvah saseh shazman grama, like lula, like shofar, and yet we paskin that if a woman wants to do a mitzvah saseh shazman grama, she is allowed to, and for Ashkenazim, she could even make a bracha. So logically, tefillin should fall exactly into that category, but of course, we do have a psak of the Ramah that tefillin, because of its kedusha, is different, and a woman should not put on tefillin unless she's an exceptional tzaddikas privately, like Michal Bat Shaul or Rashi's daughters. Even then, there are certain exceptions. Now, there are modern Orthodox high schools in New York that have women putting on tefillin. It's interesting, the lumbus, listen to the lumbus of how they matured it. They matured it because they said this was the minhag of the family. We should not ask girls to give up the minhag of the family. Why was it the minhag of the family? Because the parents were conservative or reform Jews, and therefore they put on tefillin, so it's the minhag of the family. How, that, right? I mean, you could say the minhag of the family was the chazer, you know, let's continue family minhagim and the like. But I don't want to judge any individual person, but when teenagers put on tefillin, and maybe even adults, it's generally not because their heart is yearning to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So I would have to say most of the time, if the younger girls are putting on tefillin, it's just a show. Hey, I can do what the boys do also. Like it's the same religious motivation as a girl wanting to be in the basketball team. I mean, it's really fundamentally no different. And that's a bizayon for Kedusha. Now, so intrinsically, if a really righteous spiritual person desperately wanted to put on tefillin, we would find a heter, perhaps. Perhaps, because there are heterim in halacha. But when it just becomes, hey, if the boys can do it, I can do it, that's a bizayon hatorah. Now, let me just tell you that although intrinsically I'm not in favor of slippery slope, meaning to say I'm willing to go as far as halacha permits. I'm not going to say can't have a Kabbalah Shabbos service because if you do that you're going to have a woman rabbi. I would say no, we can draw the line. But I will tell you that there is a reason to be choshish for this. Because I mentioned 10 years ago the issue was women's minyanim. Well, I have to tell you, now in 2015, 57, 75, the issue is not women's minyanim, the issue is partnership minyanim. This is an absolutely different development. With partnership minyanim, what they do is they have women in a mixed service actually conduct the parts of the service that technically do not require a minyan. So you'll have a woman chazanit in the show, in an Orthodox show, who will do psukei de zimra. She then switches for a man to do from Borchu till after Chazaras Hashatz, and then the woman comes back and does Enkelokeinu and Anim Zemiros. Sometimes they keep Kolisha and they chant it, sometimes they sing it. But of course they do have a mechitza, so the woman stands, you know, so what you're doing is you're doing everything exactly. We have a mechitza, etc. A woman chazanit going back and forth, and some of them have even gone further and they have given women aliyos, and textually they have a raya, because the Gemara says meyikir adin, a woman could be aila l'tayra, but it's not covered for the tzibor. So their argument is, if it's only a question of covered at tzibor, we can be mochel on our kavod. And we're mochel. They officially say the tzibor is mochel. So what's interesting is what used to be the problem of women separately doing stuff has now become mamish a taruvus. Here in here in Yerushalayim, in Katzimon, there's a big so-called Orthodox synagogue, and these are people who are Shomer Shabbos. I mean, they are Orthodox in many parts of their lives. Called Shira Chadasha, which is a partnership minyan, right? So the MS is things do go from bad to worse. So one has to be very, very careful.
Is that okay, though?
It is absolutely not okay.
Why not?
Well, it's not okay, number one, because the whole purpose of a mechitza, I mean, what you're doing is you're turning mechitza into a superficial, ridiculous, meaningless thing. You have a mechitza, and then you have women going back and forth and participating in the middle of a service. The whole idea of a mechitza is men and women should not be jointly participating in religious worship. Again, mainly because of men being sexually distracted. It really is a put-down of men. So to have a mechitza, but then have women be equal participants in the service, is a stira. It's a contradiction to the idea of mechitza. Women's aliyas also is not halachically allowed because Chazal regarded kavodat zibur as a non-negotiable, non-waivable aspect that is intrinsically a bizayin for the zibur.
Back on the beginning of what you said about the curse of the sukkah, I don't know the curse exactly, but I heard that there were some blessings bestowed upon the moon because God felt bad, so to speak, for the moon. So therefore he said, oh, those Jewish people will bless you, and you'll shine by day too.
Well, yeah, but that's exactly right, but that's Limos HaMashiach.
Nowadays the moon shines at during the day.
You're referring to the early morning, you mean, when you see the moon.
For example.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
So, and he said that the Jewish people will bless him every month.
Yeah, that's right.
So do those two blessings or compromises to the woman also affect the woman nowadays, like in a kosher way, she gets a different type of status?
Well, again, I mean, there's no question that when Chazal described even marriage, they say that a husband must love his wife as he loves himself, and he must honor her more than he honors himself. So there's no question that if men are not honoring women properly, it's not because of the Torah. It's against the Torah. And although HaKadosh Baruch Hu did make the man the so-called king, but as the Rambam says, if the man is the king, the wife has to be the queen, and a man who does not treat his wife like a queen does not deserve to be treated like a king. So there is no question that those brachos might feed into it as well. But until the Mashiach comes, there will be this distancing between men and women. As we approach Mashiach, there'll be more and more equality between them. Ad kedei kach that a woman might even become dominant. That's the woman walking around the man. Yeah.
I read that Rav
Yosef Hanzonfeld. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Say again.
Rav Yosef Hanzonfeld.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
The thing is, the way how I see Rav Kook is like he made more of damage than good. I think that we say always Rav Kook was the Rav of Yoshama. One Rav Yosef Hanzonfeld was tremendous tzaddik, so.
Yeah. Well, it depends who you ask. Let me put it this way. You know, the hashgacha that's considered to be the most reliable kashrus supervision in Eretz Yisrael, maybe in the world, is the Eda Charedis, right? The Eda Charedis. Now, the Eda Charedis, let me explain a little bit what the Eda Charedis is. The Eda Charedis is really the Turei Karta without the violence. They're very, you know, they're passive. They don't make trouble, but they do not believe technically in the legitimacy of the state of Israel. But what happened was this. The Eda Charedis was established as a breakaway from the Orthodox community of Zionists, religious Zionists, who supported the state of Israel. And it was it broke away to create a separate kehillah, a separate organization that did not recognize the state of Israel. And the first Rav of the Eda Charedis, although spiritually their forefather is Rabbi Shmuel Leib Diskin, but the first Rav of the Eda Charedis was Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld. Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld was declared to be the Rav of Yerushalayim by the Eda Charedis when Rav Kook was chosen by the religious Zionists and other Rabbanim as well as the Rav of Yerushalayim. So that's why there are two Rabbanim of Yerushalayim to this very day. There is a Rav of Yerushalayim that is the Rabbanut Rav of Yerushalayim. In fact, that position was vacant, by the way, for almost 15 years, but they just got a new Ashkenazi Rav of Yerushalayim, who is Rav Aryeh Stern of Katamon, Talmud Chacham, and the Sephardic Rav of Yerushalayim. The Rabbanut is Rav Shlomo Amar, who had been chief rabbi of Sephardic, but now he's just like Rav Lau Sr. had been Rav Rashi, and now his son became Rav Rashi, and Rav Lau works for his son because he's now the Rav of Tel Aviv, moved to that. So to Rav Shlomo Amar, who was the Sephardic Rabbanut Rav of Yerushalayim, is now the Sephardic, the Rav of Rav Rashi is now the Sephardic Rav of Yerushalayim. But the Eda Charedis also has the Rav of Yerushalayim, and that's Rav Tovia Weiss, right? They're both called Rav of Yerushalayim. So there was a split, and the split was basically whether you work with the Medina or you reject the Medina. And the Eda Charedis as Shita was, number one, actually this happened before stated, so the issue wasn't stated, but the issue was working with Zionists and also a certain Hisnagdus to Rav Kook. But let me explain one thing. There were great, great Gedolim on both sides of this. You had Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnerfeld, who was a great, great Gadol. But on Rav Kook's side, you had Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, who was a great Gadol. You had Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. You had younger people like Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. They were not with the Eda Charedis. They were with Rav Kook's side. Rav Elyashiv in those days, Rav Elyashiv himself, for many years, was a Dayan. He was the head Dayan in the Rabbanut system of courts. And the Brisker Rav, who was against the Medina, told him he had to be there because it was necessary to have a great, great posek. So there were Gedolim on both sides. And let me point out as well that Rav Kook and Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld were very, very close friends. They were very close friends. They were Yedidim. They loved each other. They had different shitas. Rav Kook had certain mystical shitas that even people who are far from Torah, but if they want to build up Eretz Yisrael, that's because of something good within them, and you have to nurture that, you have to be mechazik that. And Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld felt that we have to separate from people who are technically Rishayim to build up the strength of our own Yiddishkeit. These were different shitas. Now, it may be that their followers, as is often the case, were insulting each other, were disparaging each other, were putting each other in chayrim, but at the level of the great rabbis themselves, they were great, great, great chaverim. They loved each other. In the early 1900s, before Rav Kook was the Rav of Yerushalayim, he was the Rav of Yaffa. Remember Yaffa, there's Tel Aviv Yaffa. Now Yaffa is a little fishing village. But in the 1920s, either there was no Tel Aviv or Tel Aviv just started. Yaffa was a bigger city than Tel Aviv. And Rav Kook came from Lithuania to become the Rav of Yaffa. And he and Rav Zonnenfeld and some other Rabbanim, they took a six-month trip to all the kibbutzim, all the moshavim, all the little places in the north that were filled with people who weren't keeping mitzvahs. It was called the Tshuva campaign. To be mechazik people was that, and they did a tremendous amount. Both Rav Zonnenfeld and Rav Kook. They tell the story that one time, what was it? It was kind of, I don't remember the whole story, but a grandson of Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld had to go to Rav Kook's house for something. And he was so frightened because he had heard that Rav Kook is like the wicked witch of the West or whatever it is. He's going to eat him up. The child was like a six-year-old child. And he was really shivering to go to Rav Kook's house. You know, he's going to see all these Apikorsim, Bialik, and Eliezer ben Yehuda. You know, Rav Kook had a lot of different types of people in his house. And he felt he was going to walk through a lion's den. And he described later how Rav Kook called him in and he stroked him and he kissed him and he said, you know, your grandfathers and I are one of the best friends. There's nothing to be afraid of. You know, I believe in the Torah too and I serve Hashem too. And he spoke to the child like for an hour privately. So Rav Kook did have shitos that were very, very controversial. He was a great guy in Shas and Paiskim. He was a Talmud of the Netziv in Volozhin. He was considered to be the best Talmud of the Netziv in Volozhin. The Netziv said that if the whole yeshiva would only produce one Talmud like Rav Kook, it was worth all the years, all the work of the yeshiva. And Rav Kook in particular expressed the idea that within every, he got it from Hasidus really, but that within every Jew there is a goodness and a holiness. Now, Rav Zonnenfeld agrees 100%, but Rav Zonnenfeld felt there was a difference between how you relate to individual Jews and how you relate to movements. He said, B'yechidus, we relate to every single Jew as precious, but we don't endorse movements that are against halacha, because that would be legitimating them and the like. That was a big machlokas. And that is why Rav Zonnenfeld never called Rav Kook the Rav of Yerushalayim. Throughout his life he called him the Rav of Yaffa, because he said Yaffa was a hick town. Yaffa was a small village. In a small village, Rav Kook's approach was exactly right. Every Jew you respect, every Jew you love, every Jew you treat well. It's one-to-one. But once you're doing national Jewish leadership, world Jewish leadership, you have to have a stricter position. So he said Rav Kook was a wonderful Rav of Yaffa, but Rav Kook was not, he felt, the Shita was, he was not the Rav of Yerushalayim. So remember, Rav Kook's career was in three stages. He was the Rav of Yafo, he was then the Rav of Yerushalayim under British mandatory authority, and then he was appointed to be the chief rabbi of Palestine. He died before there was a state of Israel, so he was never a rabbi in the state of Israel per se. And the Eidah Charedis did not recognize the last two positions. They only recognized him as the Rav of Yafo.
Well,
I can ask you, how many times have you heard Rav Kook's name in Or Sameach? The basic idea is this: in most, not all, in most of the Haredi world, Rav Kook is ignored. In a significant fraction of the Haredi world, he is abused. Now that is a big avera. Rav Yashiv or Shlomo Zalman, they were machshiv Rav Kook tremendously, and they considered people that were mavazeh Rav Kook to this day to be committing a very serious avera of mavazeh Talmud Chacham. So it's not an insignificant. I mean, maybe 25%. I can't give you an exact number who are actively mavazeh Rav Kook, even calling him an apikoris, God forbid, and the like. But for 75%, maybe 72%, they just ignore it. They basically say, this is not our shita, the Torah world, so how they define the Torah world, doesn't go with them. There's a small group, which maybe I count myself, which looks at Rav Kook with a great, great deal of respect and understanding that some of his shitas were controversial, and understanding that the machloksim between Gedolim, including Rav Kook and other Gedolim, is something that might be above us, but we have to respect and understand the different approaches, looks at Rav Kook with great, great, tremendous admiration. So all I can tell you is that the mainstream just ignores him, but at the two extremes you have people who denigrate and detract, and people who actively admire. In the religious Zionist world, of course, which is also a Torah community, don't forget that, in the religious Zionist world, Rav Kook is the great, great icon. But even then, the problem with Rav Kook generally is he was a very, very deep and complicated thinker. Besides being an absolute Baki in Babli, Yerushalmi, Medrash, Zohar, Kabbalah, he knew everything. Some people actually describe Rav Kook as maybe the last Gadol that was sholeit b'chol ha-Torah kula, halacha and agada, Kabbalah and Nigla. Perhaps he was the last one who was in all of those areas. But because of this, his thought is very complicated. And what you have is different groups of Talmidim and Talmidei Talmidim, they tend to grasp one aspect of him and not the other aspect. So a very significant part of the Dati Leumi community grasps Rav Kook's Hashkafa on Eretz Yisrael. And they say, can't give back territories, can't disengage, no matter what happens. We got to get rid of the Arabs. Like, that's one view. And yet there's another part of Rav Kook that talked about the notion that even Goyim are made in the image of God and you have to treat the Arabs with kavod. You see, Rav Kook embraces all of those different ideas, but different groups take one idea and not the other idea. I don't know if you know the Dati Leumi Gedolim, but if you take, for example, Rav Kook's own son, who became the Rosh Yeshiva of Merkas Harav after Rav Kook was Nifter, he emphasized over and over again Kedushas Eretz Yisrael, and that's why his followers were very militant against disengagement, against territorial concession, and they sometimes would trample on the rights of Arab minorities. Rav Amital, who was a Rosh Yeshiva with Rav Lichtenstein in Gush Emunim, was also a Talmud of Rav Kook, and he emphasized Rav Kook's morality towards every human being and how you have to respect the rights of Eviv and Goyim. And he pointed out that, I don't know, he did a word count. Rav Kook spent more words in his writing on that than even Eretz Yisrael. Right? So Rav Amital, who was a chashuva person, he was a chaver of Rav Shach when he was younger, talked about the idea that disengagement would be halachically permitted, as Rav Shach himself said. So there's a children's story called The Seven Men and the Elephant. I don't know if you ever heard of this. Seven Blind Men and the Elephant, in which seven blind men were asked to describe an elephant. So one blind person feels the ears and says, oh, an elephant is a gigantic butterfly. Another person feels the trunk. Oh, an elephant is a big snake. a third person feels the, around the stomach and says, oh, an elephant is like a hippopotamus. Now, all of them are right, but all of them are only seeing part of the story. And there's a whole story that nobody is getting. And this is true for many, many Gedolim. This is true for Rav Soloveitchik of Yeshiva University. This is true of Rav Kook. These are multifaceted, complicated, complex patterns of thought. And most of us don't do well with complexity. We like to have a simple bottom line. But that simple bottom line is a distortion. So maybe the Haredi world might be right that Rav Kook might be too complicated for most of us to handle. And Mimela, maybe it's better to get away. But on the other hand, the message of Avas Yisrael and the message of loving a Jew and the message of seeing the goodness in a Jew is a message that we need to hear more often. I understand that, you know, no gadol is again. No gadol will say, I'm in favor of sinas chinam. I understand that. I understand that. That every single zerem in Klal Yisrael that's authentic says we have to work on sinas chinam. But it's not always emphasized that much. In other words, often what we emphasize is how bad the other side is. And we need to hear Rav Kook. We need to hear that other aspect of it to kind of bring us back to Avas Yisrael. So that's kind of a long answer. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep.
So you talked about it already, but I didn't plan on asking you, but the Haredi view on Zionism, with regardless of anything else, regardless of the secular nature of Zionism, how it started, whatever, Israel houses about 47% of the world's Jews, right? It's like 45 and 50. So from the Tilomi perspective, when Tony Carter or Rasat Marha City openly denounce Israel, enemies of Israel use it to kill people in olive uniforms. So is that allowed halakhically?
No, so that's 100%. So this is why I said, I think I even said this a few weeks ago, this is why there actually is an important difference between the Eda Haredis and the Tilomi Carter. That is, both of them had a shita that it is wrong for the Jewish people to have a state until the coming of Mashiach. Like, they're in agreement with that. And had they been able to turn the clock back, they would have preferred that Israel remain either under mandatory authority, which it almost certainly would not have been, or even have an Arab state. And they have some hashkafa that somehow God would have allowed us to live here and have freedom of worship, and although that's not so likely. But that's their shita. But the difference between them is, what do you do with facts on the ground? In other words, the reason why the Eda Haredis does not engage in really public denunciations of the state is because they recognize if Lamaisa you have a situation where there are millions and millions of Jews in this country, including them, and Lamaisa any anti-Israel sentiment could result in Jewish lives being killed, they say, we have to be quiet. We have to be quiet. They actually take exactly your position. We will not do anything that will endanger Jewish lives, and therefore we will have to tolerate a matzav that we would have preferred does not exist, but given the reality, we will tolerate it. That's the Eda Haredis' position. The Turei Karta, which, by the way, it's not a big group. I mean, Turei Karta is a relatively small group, but
there's Samar and also like Tolzar.
Yes, Samar is a little bit. Yeah, you're correct. Oh, the Tolzar, personally, very nice people, by the way. They are very sweet people. But they believe, based on their mystical idea, that the Fakert, if we oppose this evil state, Hashem will put Rachamim and love in the hearts of all of our enemies. Again, it seems to be very unrealistic. And I don't think the Satmar Rebbe himself, it's a Chaval that unfortunately the original Satmar Rebbe is not alive to guide us or guide them. But I don't think he would have been in favor. In fact, I'll tell you a Satmar story, a really great story. You might remember, you weren't born then, but you may remember from your history. In 1968, when Nixon was running for his first presidential term, so the Democrat that was running against him was Hubert Humphrey. Hubert Humphrey was Lyndon Johnson's vice president. Now, Hubert Humphrey was an old-fashioned Minnesota liberal. He supported Israel. He was a Zionist. He supported Israel, 1945, even before the state. And his support for Israel was unconditional. In those days, liberals used to support Israel, not like today. Today it's a little bit of the opposite. So Humphrey wanted to get the Jewish vote. And Humphrey figured he would get the Jewish vote because he's a big supporter of Israel. So he heard there was a lot of Orthodox Hasidic Jews in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And he asked somebody to arrange a campaign stop. It was a Satmar stop. So Humphrey comes, And there's an interpreter, the Satmar Rebbe was there, you know. And Humphrey gives his big speech about Israel. I have been supporting the state of Israel since 1948. This is right after the Six-Day War, right after. He says, and Ad Hayom Hazeh, I was the reason why they got weapons to fight the Six-Day War, you know, and I will stand behind Israel's security no matter what. So one of his campaign advisors, who was not involved in the meeting, but happened to be have a Jewish background, realized, ay, 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 he's giving this speech to someone who is absolutely against the state of Israel, who's anti-Zionist, who believes Zionists are Rishoyim. He's going to lose 100,000 votes, because Satmar is a very, very big group, and that could throw New York City. 100,000 votes could easily change a state. And, well, remember in Florida, with George Bush, much less than that, you know, determined their presidential election. It really is true. A very small number of votes can change a presidential election. So the person goes over to the Satmar Rebbe afterwards. And Satmar Rebbe is like smiling and nodding, good, 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 good. So he goes over to the Satmar Rebbe and says, you know, Rebbe, please, please forgive us. You know, Humphrey is a guy, you know, he doesn't know these differences in the Jewish community. He doesn't understand the nuances. His heart is a good heart, you know, he just didn't know what he was saying. Satmar Rebbe said, no problem. He says, I have big, big disagreements with the Zionist state, but they are disagreements within our family. You know, we are family and family fight. But when it comes to protecting them from the outsiders, he says, I don't want a single soldier or a single Jew in Israel to be hurt. And if by giving them weapons, they will be able to protect themselves against enemies who want to destroy them, he says, I'm in favor of it. That's a pretty amazing thought. Here you have a person who actually felt there should not be a state of Israel. But as long as there are Jews in Israel, and as long as they're being attacked, I will use even the Zionist state to protect them. And that's fascinating. I'm not sure if modern Turi character would go along with that. But you see, this is how a true Gadol sees it. A true Gadol understands that you don't endanger the Jewish people. And so I think that itself would be the answer to your question, which is why I think Neturei Karta, even if philosophically there is a basis for their view, you know, and there is a basis, I'm not going to deny it, but operationally you don't disparage a Jewish state. You don't endanger Jewish lives. Yeah?
I just have a previous topic.
Yeah?
From a health standpoint, if there's a amount of money to spend on campaigning against this Israel versus money being channeled into, let's say, Kyrgyzstan. From a Halachic standpoint, what would be most wise?
You know, that's a very, very, very hard question. I mean, I think Klal Yisrael does need both, very importantly. I would channel it into Kiruv, but I would want to make Kiruv programs very much emphasize Avas Yisrael. Meaning to say, I think part of, sometimes in our Kiruv Rechokim, we identify certain things as very important, which of course they are. Keeping kosher, keeping Shabbos, learning Torah, those are absolutely very, very, very important. But we sometimes don't emphasize Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. We don't emphasize Avas Yisrael. So I think, theoretically, maybe it's naive, you could get the best of both worlds, in which your Jewish outreach will be an outreach that incorporates within it the values of Avas Yisrael and caring about each other. Because it really is a chaval. When Kirov, see, I think it gets me into so many related things. Sometimes one of the methodologies that we use in Kiruv, it's a methodology, it's an approach, is to show how bad the other side is. Meaning to say, whoever the other side is, the other side might be Zionist, the other side might be evolutionist, the other side might be conservative or Reform Jews. Like you sometimes will hear a presentation, 20 reasons why Reform Judaism is, you know, false, inauthentic, fake, evil. So you come in and you'll hear a class which will give you an hour of a lecture of how bad the other people are. And although in a sense everything has its place, because you need to know the ideologies and what's the problem with them, etc. But I think in some ways it's counterproductive, because it just creates more of a sense of we versus them, as opposed to looking at every Jew as something precious. So I think it's shayach to have a kiruv which is not so much about talking about how bad the other guy is, but to talk about what Yiddishkeit is, and No, the way you attack darkness is not by taking a baseball bat and hitting darkness. Darkness doesn't go away with a baseball bat. But as you generate light, so the darkness goes away by itself. And this is even true with Goyim. I mean, I'll give you an example. Even to spend a lot of time talking about how bad the Goyim are. Not so good. I mean, you don't have to talk about how bad the Goyim are. There are nice Goyim out there in the world as well. And they contribute to the world. And some of them will get Olam Haba like a Jew, as the Rambam says. Chassidei Umos Olam. In fact, I'll give you an example how dangerous this can be. You know, years ago, around 25 years ago, we had a young man in Or Sameach, a brilliant person. He was born a non-Jew and he underwent a Geirus. And his parents were missionaries. Now, this wasn't necessarily public knowledge, but his parents were Christian missionaries. And he comes to Or Sameach and he's hearing a lot of classes about the Goyim and why Christianity is wrong, whatever it is. And he felt, you know, ultimately he left Yiddishkeit. He left Yiddishkeit because he could not take having his parents condemned to hell, you know, over and over and over and over and over again. One has to be careful, you know. When we talk about Abikorsim and Rishoyim and Kofrim, you know, we're talking about sometimes people's parents, you know. So, this is, again, I'm sorry I'm giving such long-winded answers today, but my short answer is, that when a kirov is miyusad, not on talking about other people's chesronos, but by talking about what Judaism has to offer, then I think you get the best of both worlds. You get kirov rechokim and you get avas Yisrael at the same time. And I'll just leave you with a final point. Certainly we're in the period right before Tisha B'Av, where we think about Sinas Shechina. And again, I've said this a lot, and much greater, you know, great Rosh Hashivas have said this as well, so it's not only, it's not my chiddush. That is, you know, we live in a time, particularly in Israel, where there's great tension between religious and secular. Great tension. The issue of the army is a major issue. The issue of support for Torah is a major issue. And the Olam HaTorah has tended to portray this in warlike, paradoxically, the fight against the army has been portrayed as a war. We have an enemy that's trying to destroy us, and we have to fight them as a war. It would appear that much of the tension would be diffused if the Olam HaTorah could bring a sense of respect for what other people are doing in Israeli society. If, for example, we would have appreciation for soldiers who do fight in the army, if we would understand that they too are contributing to the security of Eretz Yisrael, if we would understand that they too are enabling people to learn Torah and do mitzvahs, and we would have hakara satov and kavod for what they do, then they would have hakara satov and kavod for what the spiritual part of Am Yisrael is doing. Because Shlomo HaMelech says, Kamayim apanim apanim, kein leif adam liadam. What does that mean? Water reflects the face that you show water. I smile at the water, I get back a smiling face. I frown at the water, I get back a frowning face. Shlomo HaMelech says, as water reflects the heart that you show it, the heart of a human being reflects back what you show it. If I treat another human being like an enemy, like a demon, like a Russia, they will look at me as an enemy, a demon, and a Russia.
What if they are Russia?
Huh?
What if they are?
I understand, but the truth of the matter is that a person might be a Russia is the opposite,
right?
Because of ignorance, because of a lack of acceptance, meaning they might be doing, again, a person could be doing maisim that are vicious, 100%. That doesn't mean they are a Russia. In fact, you have kinok shenishba, you have lack of background. It's been said that people are too ignorant to be Rishayim. Spinoza was a Russia. The early Zionists, perhaps. But now people are just ignorant. You know, people are ignorant. They're not exposed. The truth of the matter is, many, many secular Israelis, their secret is a little bit of a secret. They really, really want to become a little more religious. But they're afraid that they have to become Haredi. They say, you know, I don't want to wear a black coat in the summer. It's too hot. Meaning they would like to light Shabbos candles. They would like to go to shul. They would like to have tradition. They would like even to keep kosher. But they're just afraid they're going to have to go so far that they don't want to do it. So as a result, they become, you know, militant. They move to the other way because they're so afraid of becoming. So the question you can always ask is, well, if you're telling me if I respect you, you'll respect me, then, well, let them start. You know, after all, I mean, I'm living a life of Torah. They ought to respect me. Then I'll respect them. Like, why do I have to start? You know, it's a good question, but you know, that's life. If you're a Torah Jew, then you realize that, you know, you've got to do what's right without making a cheshbon, oh, the other person didn't do it yet. And I think in many, many ways, if there could be genuine derech eretz and hakara satov, I mean, for example, I could look at a chayal, for many chayalim are religious, that's one thing, but I can look at a non-religious chayal, and I can say, listen, okay, Shabbos kashrus, that's too bad, okay, whatever, but the person is risking his life to save Jews. And that should count. That should count for something. And if I would be machshiv that, I think they would also be machshiv.
I know you're trying to go along. So that makes sense for, like, talking about our Jewish brothers.
Yep.
What about our cousins? That might be Russia as well, and Russian as well.
Well, you're right. You're right. It's far. I was not referring to that. Referring to how we relate to them. Although I think there's some truth there as well. But unfortunately, I think there, you're dealing with people who are so far, 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 far gone. That maybe some people are beyond therapy. That is very true. But even then, to the new generation, there might be things that one could think about, to the newer generation. Meaning, the problem is that these Arab kids are poisoned from almost birth. You know, I once saw they have Sesame Street here. So they have, you know, every country has its own Sesame Street version, you know, with cute puppets and cartoons. So I once saw a snippet of a Sesame Street show in one of these in Palestinian territories, or, you know, and they have, like, you know, this cute little cartoon character that, you know, takes a machine gun and guns down Jews, says, oh, wow, kill 10 Yehudim, 10 Yehudim, you know. I mean, this is what they're teaching, like, a 2-year-old kid, you know. So that already, you know, you're really dealing with a lot of problems. But I'm talking about army, religious, secular. And I'll tell you this, there are surveys in newspapers where Israelis are asked, what is the number one problem that Israel faces? And there, you know, unfortunately, you can make a big list of problems. Security, you know, nuclear war, Islamofascism, Palestinian terrorism, Hamas, Hezbollah, even the cost of housing, water, you know, there are a lot of economic disparities. These are very big issues here. But the number one problem that is mentioned in every survey, and it makes no difference if the respondent is Chiloni, Charedi, Dati Lumi, Chardal, you know, any type of person on the spectrum, is the lack of unity that exists among Jews. So everyone knows that somehow the Eibishter will give us Siyata Dishmaya if we can have that Achdus and the like. So especially during this Zaman of the Chorban Beis HaMikdash, this is something really to think about very, very much. And in many ways, I have to say, well, not everybody here is American, so forgive me for my American reference. But this applies to people from Western countries generally, so it's Lav Dafka America. So I apologize for my U.S. centricism. But this is something that I think Western Olim can contribute, because one of the strong points that Westerners have is maybe a greater tolerance of different types of Jews. Now, some people might say, oh, that's a chisaron, you don't stand for anything. You know, in America, you're so soft on religious values that I'm okay, you're okay, you know, gay rights is okay, and abortion is okay, and, you know, everything like that. Which is some degree is true, meaning the reason maybe why we're tolerant is because, you know, we're less religious. That might be so. But I think at its root, there is a certain thing that people can learn from each other, meaning we could learn from the Charedim of Eretz Yisrael to be strong and fiery and committed and passionate about Yiddishkeit. But they can learn from the other side to be a little more accepting. Now, can you have both at the same time? That's a difficult challenge. But the emphasis is in the mixtures of populations, each can bring something to the other that can bring a greater shleimus to Am Yisrael. So, B'ezras Hashem, we hope that we should be zeicha to bring the Gula Shleima from Hera.